to me. Oh! Oh!
I live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York City. And I welcome you from all over the world. You can watch today's program by going to Ustream channel and then searching for Gary Null. You can listen over the telephone, as record number of people are doing, by calling the following number. In fact, coming down to our studio today in mid-Manhattan, there was a driver who said every day, he recognized me and he said, every day I listen to the show over the telephone. I put it on speaker and I got a modified speaker and somehow he took it into his car system and he's able to have the show where he can listen to it and people in the car can. And he said, I really appreciated yesterday's program. It touched my heart. Good. You can also listen anywhere if you're out with any portable listening device in case you're not by a land-based station or you're not near your internet. Let me give you that number. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. And I believe we're passing around 28 million minutes listened, which is number one in North America and Canada. So thank you. Today we're going to talk about health and nutrition as we always begin our program with diabetes and why it's so important for the pre-diabetic and diabetic to follow a healthy protocol. And I'll explain why and what that protocol should be. Also, and that's from the University of Leeds, United Kingdom, and from the University of Barcelona, how mycobacterium in olive oil is used for cancer treatment, and then how broccoli sprouts can protect against oral cancer recurrence, University of Pittsburgh Cancer Center, and a separate article done at the University of Illinois shows that broccoli itself, not the sprouts, reduces your risk of four major diseases, and that's why you should have broccoli each day or cruciferous vegetables, preferably every day in your diet. I'll go over what those are. New research links monk fruit, M-O-N-K, to cancer healing. We'll give you the latest on that. And staying productive while at work has got its benefits. Harvard University Medical School and memory loss protection from a single food that you wouldn't think about. We'll share that. All of this comes from quality independent science. Then today, a special report, an original investigative report, 17 reasons to say no to glyphosate this summer, or at any time for that matter, but this summer because I was asked by one of the people in the audience, would I testify before a hearing to help get rid of the spraying of glyphosate out of the New York City parks and their different areas that they spray. I said, yes, I'll be happy to testify. I've testified before in front of the city council years ago. But in case I'm not invited to testify or can't, this report will be posted today. And for anyone, anywhere in America or around the world, download this report. It is fully scientifically, scholarly referenced, meaning my reports, any lawyer, any activist can take into any court or hearing and know that you have science and truth on your side. Hundreds and hundreds of cities and towns and communities have had members of this audience download my fluoride fiasco over the last 30 years and use it to defluoridate their water. So this is a public service article written by myself and two of our scholars in residence, Richard Gale and Jeremy. Now, my guest today is going to talk about that part of American foreign policy that Bernie Sanders unfortunately supports, that Hillary Clinton is an architect of, and that whether Democrat or Republican, including Clinton and Obama, as well as Bush, have all supported regime change in Central and South America, specifically in this case, Venezuela. So we're going to have on someone who will tell you the truth, to show you how you cannot trust the American media on any of these issues. And that will be Eva Gollinger. She is a Venezuelan-American attorney. She served briefly as the foreign policy advisor to the late Hugo Chavez. And using Freedom of Information Act requests, she continues to document the close relationship between the radical right factions, the corporate Democrats in Venezuela, and the U.S. government's actions to overthrow the Chavez government. She's received Mexico's International Journalism Award, and she's one of the most prestigious journalist litigators in Latin America. She's a member of the New York Bar, the Bar of the U.S. Supreme Court, and other bars. So she's going to be on talking about challenging all of mainstream media, the New York Times in particular. No better mouthpiece for corporate America than the New York Times. So what's really going on? You'll hear today. Also today, the New York Times, NBC, CNN, all of the mainstream media, just this week, ran with a story showing that GMOs are safe. The National Academy of Science released a report showing they're safe. No, they're not. And here's the issue. The New York Times, CBS, NBC, Fox, they have substantial research resources, and they're not using it. They chose to run with the story they were given instead of seeing whether or not the story was objective and honest. We, on the other hand, we are not political. We are not ideological. We have no allegiance to anything except the truth. That's what makes us progressive. And we will show you where the National Academy of Science is wrong. All the media that parroted their comments are wrong. So we will take on the entire establishment today to show you just how bad it is. And we will use actual science. And we will cite our science. And we will post our science. And my hope is that all the listeners download the post, take what is being said, and Richard Gale, one of our scholars in residence, will state the facts. And then my hope is you take this information and challenge the media. Why is it that we, with so few resources, are able to constantly, year in, decade in, tell the truth, and they just can't find it? So that's our show. We have a lot to share. Plus, there'll be some audio clips, time permitting. Who are the largest perpetrators of drug trades in the world? You'll be surprised by that special report. And then also, there's a young lady who I just watched early this morning. She just stands in front of a camera. I'm guessing she's in her early 20s. And she shows you photographs where she was there to support Obama. And she's been a good Democrat and a good liberal until she looked for what was going on. And then she gives you her insight. I think it is a wonderful talk back. I'll share that. So we have those to share with you as well. Let's begin. Diabetes is not epidemic, it is pandemic. It is killing more Americans in 1 year than all terrorist activity have in American history. It is a plague upon us. The latest study shows that one half of all adults in America are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. That's really serious. Why? Because with diabetes, you are going to die much sooner. And that's why we must make every effort to be honest with the public, irrespective of what the lobbyists for those special food groups, the sugar people and the refined confectionery people and the meat people tell us that we should be consuming. We know the causes of diabetes. We just don't seem to have the political will or the honesty to challenge it. This is the latest from the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. Diabetes raises the risk of a heart attack, death, by 50%. 50%. Quote, having diabetes increases the risk of dying from the effects of a heart attack by around 50%. researchers at the University of Leeds tracked 700,000 people who had been admitted to hospital with a heart attack in the last 10 years. Of these, 121,000 had diabetes. After stripping out the effects of age, sex, and other illnesses, and differences in the emergency medical treatment received, the team found a stark difference in survival rates. People with diabetes were 56% more likely to have died if they had experienced an ST elevation myocardial infarction heart attack, in which the coronary artery is completely blocked, than those without the condition. They were 39% more likely to have died if they had a non-ST elevation myocardial infarction heart attack, in which the artery is partially blocked, than those without diabetes. Quote, the partnership between cardiologists and GPs and diabetic experts needs to be strengthened, and we need to make sure we are using established medical procedures as effectively as possible among high-risk individuals. I think that is absolutely wrong. I think that is deadly. Why? Because the average physician is absolutely clueless about anything involving natural healing. And yet every one of these ads, watch, you'll see it for yourself, where something is improved, it always says, this medication along with diet and exercise. Well, how can you say this medication along with diet and exercise? How do you know it wasn't the diet and exercise that did the healing instead of the medication? Show me where the drug by itself reversed a disease. I'd like to see that. Can you show it to me? I can show you a lot of people dying because of the medication you're giving. And I can show you a nation that is morbidly overweight because of insulin. And I can show you people who've said, their doctor said, I got to stay on insulin the rest of my life. And then I put people in a health protocol and they're no longer diabetic. How's that possible? How's it possible someone who was diagnosed with diabetes and given two medications to take daily was morbidly obese for 22 years, within 3 months was no longer diabetic, no longer requiring insulin, their doctor took them off, and lost 85 pounds, and recovered their vascular strength, better circulation of the brain, and no longer had intermittent claudication pains in the calves, and pains at night? That's just one example, and that's a person all the people in this audience know, who's been on this program and on her own show, has acknowledged this. But this is common. It is so easy to prevent and reverse diabetes. But to do so, you have to have a complete commitment to change. That means no more French fries, pizzas, hot dogs, hamburgers, cookies, no more milkshakes, no more diet soda, no more sodas, no more caffeine, no more the common foods and comfort foods that we consume that are dead, denatured, and diseased. No, we're talking about living foods, raw foods as much as possible, juicing, healthy, chlorophyll, flooding the body, polyphenols and nutrients, exercising twice a day for a half hour, and meditating and dealing with stress appropriately, and some nutrients that can balance the blood sugar. That works. So saying that we're going to have a heart attack by up to 56% if we're diabetic, and then you think, well, isn't it heart attacks that are number one medical cause of death in the United States? Yeah. Over 680,000? Yes. So what if half to three quarters of all the people dying of heart attacks are diabetics? Well, then you're looking at upwards of 300,000 people, 200,000 to 300,000 people who didn't have to die. But medicine won't give them a lifestyle or behavior modification protocol. They'll give them the drug. So shame on medicine, you have failed. And it's time that you are called out and put on notice. In the future, people will not be trusting you except for where you are exemplary and where I recommend people use emergency medicine. There, absolutely, you are the best. Everything else, you fail miserably. Mycobacterium. This is an interesting article from the University of Barcelona. And here's what it says. It says that researchers at the University of Barcelona, with collaboration with the Institute of Bioengineering at Catalunya, were able to work for a year on a process and found that the cells of the Mycobacterium brumae offer an improved alternative to current bladder cancer treatments, and which can cause infections. And they've been looking at ways to do this, and they found that one of the ways is to use olive oil. And the olive oil made a big difference. It was a prominent, quote, immune response in both in vitro and vivo experiments. Olive oil preserves the viability of the mycobacteria and provide higher anti-clumping rates. That means less likelihood to have a clot and less likelihood to have a stroke or a heart attack. So if you're taking olive oil every day, good for you. And keep taking the olive oil, organic, cold-pressed, but also eating olives. Olives also are terrific. And I would suggest even making a pate. Here's a simple way of making something that can be like a little nourishing food, a little grazing food. You take four or five different types of olive. You can have oil-cured olives, which are generally flat and pressed, or you can have regular olives, and rinse them, put them in a blender, blend them, add in some peppers, and if you don't have fresh jalapeno, and you don't need much, just a little tiny bit, also you can add in some mustard seed and blend that with some fennel. And then that's a pate. And you put that on some rice crackers, and it's delicious. Or you can stuff it into an avocado, and it's delicious. But it's giving you the polyphenols, and that can help keep your blood thinner, and that keeps you alive longer. Try to get a broccoli sprout of 2 to 3 ounces, which is a lot, into a salad on a daily basis. You can sprout them yourself, and it costs you just pennies, compared to the $5 or $6 for buying a little box of broccoli sprouts. This is the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. And here's what it says. Potent doses of broccoli sprout activate a detoxification gene and may help prevent cancer reoccurrence in survivors of head and neck cancer. That's according to their research. And this was presented at the American Association of Cancer Research's annual meeting. Quote, it is the first study demonstrating that the extract protects against oral cancer with the results of human animal laboratory tests reported in the journal Cancer Prevention Research. With head and neck cancer, quote, we often clear patients of cancer only to see it come back with deadly consequences a few years later. Unfortunately, previous efforts to develop a preventative drug to reduce this risk have been inefficient, intolerable, impatient, and expensive. That led us to green chemo prevention, the cost-effective development of treatments based upon whole plants or their extracts. Well, this audience knows that the most important anti-cancer preventative or treatment that you can put in your diet would be broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale, cabbage, bok choy, watercress, mustard. These and others are very powerful. Daikon, very powerful at preventing cancer. Now, you can have these raw, you can juice some of them, but you got to do it as a dilution juice, meaning maybe 1 ounce of this and 32 ounces of other diluting juices, apple juice, celery, cucumber, because it's very concentrated. And then you have this. And these have molecules in them called sulforaphanes, which previously have been shown to protect people against environmental carcinogens. So there's indole-3 carbonyls, there's all these wonderful chemicals in cruciferous vegetables, but this now shows the sprouts can help prevent the reoccurrence of neck cancers, throat cancers. But here's the logic. Anything that is natural that can reverse a disease can also prevent a disease. So if you know someone who smokes and you can't get them to stop, then try to make sure that they're having this. Now, I realize there's a lot of frustration when you're trying to help someone and they just reject it. So what do you do? Well, what I suggest is, let's say you have someone with dementia or Alzheimer's or someone who's just not going to take the right foods in their body. Get your concentrates. You can get them in liquid. You can get them in powders. The powder is always your best because it's the most concentrated. It's so far more concentrated, sometimes as many as 33 times more concentrated than if you ate the whole food. And then you ask them, what's your favorite flavor? Let's say it's strawberries or bananas. You make a smoothie. In the smoothie, you put the compounds in there. If it's an oil like black cumin seed oil, or if it's flaxseed oil or coconut oil, if it's polyphenols from berries, or the healing nutrients, antioxidants from vegetables, you throw it all in. And you put some good fiber in there. And you put some probiotics. Then you blend it with a liquid that is a neutralizing liquid. What do I mean by neutralizing? It neutralizes the excessive taste because some of these are bitters, and therefore children in particular will not drink it. And a lot of people are very finicky about their taste, so you give them a very pleasant flavor. Throw a couple bananas in, throw some strawberries in, and then blend it, and that's the dominant taste. They're going to taste that. So that way you get all their nutrients in their body, and you generally want someone to take this drink 3 times a day, in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, early evening. And that way, if they've got muscle pain, you throw in some magnesium. Combination, I would do 50-50 magnesium oxide, which has a smaller molecule, magnesium citrate, which has a higher bioavailability, but the molecule is so large, not all of it gets absorbed. So but between the two, you're getting a lot of magnesium. There goes your muscle cramps. There goes your leg pain. There goes your inability to sleep at night. If they're having trouble sleeping in the evening drink, you'll put in some valerian root. That will help them. If they have a defective immune system, you put in some astragalus. And that will also help their immune system. So, easy to do. Now, one more study, University of Illinois, broccoli reduces the risk of 4 major diseases. And it's one of the most advantageous veggies you can eat. And yet, people frequently don't. And that's broccoli. Now, I always ask someone, do you like savory? Do you like sharp? Do you like spicy? Do you like mild? Do you like bland? And based upon what they say they like, that's how I'll prepare a dish. And for example, I happen to like spicy. As many of you know who've eaten my meals back when I used to have my restaurant, I was the chef at the Fertile Earth, the first gourmet vegan restaurant in America, up on 108th and Broadway, and I know a lot of you, thousands upon thousands ate there. And then later at Gary's Place on Wednesdays, I would do all the cooking. And I always tell people, I'm not into boring or bland. So if you can't eat real zesty, tasty, then you don't want to eat my food. But if you like tasty, here's a simple recipe. You lightly steam, no more than 5 minutes, your broccoli. That opens up the lignocellulose, making it very bioavailable. After all, people are all raw foodists. Unfortunately, where they're getting some good fibers, absolutely, they're not getting a high absorption because they're not making the food bioavailable. At the end of the day, it's what nutrients are coming in, how many, and which are going to end up in your cell. So if you eat something that's just all raw, like raw cabbage or raw broccoli or cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, you're probably getting 5 to 7% of the actual nutrients. But if you steam it so it's soft, you're going to get far higher. So let's say you got your broccoli. Then after you steam it, you then blanch it. That means you pour cold water on it. And that reseals it. So the nutrients now inside. Then take some sweet red or yellow pepper and you can blend it with some sweet onion and mustard, your favorite mustard, and just a touch a little tiny, maybe an eighth of a teaspoon of honey. And you mix that around. Now baste that over your broccoli. And put some little bit of Himalayan sea salt and pepper on it. It's a completely different way of eating broccoli, but it's very tasty. Just a suggestion. So if you want to help yourself overcome or prevent four major diseases, and you're going to get more free radical scavengers, you're going to get lots of phenolic content in here, you're getting sulfur compounds, and that's what helps prevent disease, and also helps ease disease, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and immune dysregulation. That's what broccoli does. And finally, I mentioned the monk fruit. Most people have never heard of the monk fruit, M-O-N-K, or even tried it. I actually I've grown monk fruit and several other exotics because I've gotten the plants, and sometimes it might take 10 to 15 years. I've actually had a tree take 19 years, and it never bore fruit once. And now this year, it's loaded. I've taken pictures, and I'm guessing I have 1,000 fruit on one tree. Started with little tiny buds, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And what's interesting, they usually drop when you have that many. Nothing's dropped. So I'm going to take a photo, time-lapse photography, and by the time I go back home, they should be ready. And then what I'll do is I'll harvest a case of it, and I'll send it up to my office. And anyone who happens to be in the neighborhood, you're welcome at that point. I'll announce it. You're welcome to come by and just get a sample. It's my gift to you. I've done this before where I've harvested jackfruit. By the way, the largest jackfruit I ever heard about was 262 pounds. I generally get them about 27 to 30 pounds, and they're wonderful. What you don't eat fresh, and it tastes like it. Jackfruit tastes like bubble gum. It's got this very unique flavor, and you can dry it too, and then have it as like a dried piece of papaya or dried mango. But here's what the monk fruit is about. It's called the longevity fruit in China, and for good reason. For centuries, it was used in Chinese medicine. If you had digestive problems, they give you monk fruit. If you had respiratory infections, they give you monk fruit. And now they've been studying it and found out that it has tumor suppression nutrients. That's important. And the Japanese have also been using it and found that it can significantly inhibit skin cancer and tumor growth. And it also helps, according to a joint study that was published in Oncogenesis this year, that it was good in both vitro and vivo, intravenous, pancreatic cancer models. It promoted cancer cell death, and it arrested the cancer cell cycle. So that's good news. And according to the American Journal of Cancer Research, states that, quote, mongrel, M-O-G-R-O-L, a biometabolite of mongrocides found in the monk fruit, has exhibited anti-cancer activities and significantly slowed the growth of leukemia cells in a vitro study. Then there was another study in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry proved the anti-inflammatory properties. That means people with any form of inflammation, inflammation of the brain, inflammation of the joints, inflammation of the muscles, monk fruit will help. Another study from a Chinese school of medicine showed that monk fruit is anti-diabetic. So anyone with dysinsulinism or any form of metabolic disorder should have monk fruit. So now we got another important resource to help us with both the prevention and treatment of cancer based on good quality science. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment with a special report and an open challenge to the mainstream media. Why are you publishing reports without first doing homework to see, are they accurate? Are they objective? We have done that, and we are at loggerhead with them, as they are doing nothing more, in our opinion, than acting as propagandists, knowingly or not, for pharmaceutical companies. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's been a time that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough.
Oh, oh, baby. My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby.
To all of you all over the world, to all the different stations that are carrying this program, we appreciate the fact that you're willing to carry this progressive information. And in about 10 minutes, we will be joined by Eva Gullinger to talk about what the mainstream media, what all the governmental agencies in Washington will refuse to tell you the truth about, what we've really been doing in Venezuela in destabilizing their country. So that is coming up. And in a few minutes, 17 reasons to say no to glyphosate this summer. And also, just to let you know that on tomorrow's show at noon, we're going to look at everything pertaining to psychology, sociology, and political use of bullying. Now, we look at the bigger picture. That means the American political and corporate establishment has created a bullying society. We have two guests, Professor Charles Derber, Professor of Sociology at Boston College, and Professor Yale Magris, the Chancellor Professor of Anthropology at the University of Massachusetts. Both of these are research scholars, and we're going to look at how, for example, the government bullies us. Think of all the different ways that we are bullied. Search and seizures, that's bullying. Asset forfeiture, that's bullying. The National Defense Authorization Act, knowing if you're a journalist like Chris Hedges, you could be arrested, you could be interned without any rights whatsoever. That's bullying. The fact that we do not allow teachers to challenge curriculum or how it's taught. We do not allow parents and teachers to challenge the massive corrupt bureaucracies of the educational system that absorb the money that doesn't trickle down to the benefit of the students. As a result, they have decrepit facilities, the staff are underpaid, and the students frequently don't even have books in dilapidated buildings. How is that possible when you're spending $10,000 a year on students? Well, because the students don't get it. The teachers don't get it. The buildings don't get it. But those controlling this massive corrupt bureaucracy, they do. Well, that's a form of bullying when you go to protest and you're now considered an enemy of the state for protesting. So that's tomorrow. You won't want to miss that. Joining us now in studio is one of our scholars in residence and the executive producer of our Progressive Commentary Hour and Conversations with Remarkable Minds in this program, Richard Gale. Nice to have you with us, Richard.
Hi, Gary. So people may have seen in the news within the last couple weeks that all the major media is now informing us that genetically modified crops are perfectly safe for human consumption. And this was a report that came out of the National Research Council. Interesting enough, this report came out just as the Congress is about to begin convening concerning mandatory GMO labeling. And just some of the news agencies and publications reporting it, you know, Forbes is stating that, you know, these are headlines, that the debate about GMO safety is over thanks to a new study. NPR, GMOs are safe. USA Today, GMOs are not harmful to human health. Even the Huffing Post went as far as to say GMOs ruled safe to eat, but a little more nuanced, they aren't solving world hunger. And Slate was probably the most devious of all. Are GMOs safe? Yes. The case against them is full of fraud and lies. And then, of course, we have the scientific cult of what's called science-based medicine, people like Bill Gates, David Gorski, Paul Offit, and all who have jumped on this, and they're blasting this all throughout the internet. So what is the Council for of this National Research Council? And that is the research arm of the American Academy of Sciences, which many would regard as probably the most prestigious conventional medical institution we have in America. But where do they get their money from? Well, they have a certain division there, which is to rule on science findings regarding GMOs, and that board has representatives of Cargill, General Mills,
GMO,
Purina,
GMO,
which are all part of the Grocery Manufacturers Association,
GMOs,
right? All connected with Monsanto and DuPont. So it's all right. It's
not objective.
No, the real comedy of this, and for anybody with any kind of, you know, with two neurons rubbing between their ears, the comedy behind this is to look at the science. They relied completely on only two major large studies. Now, these were very, very in-depth studies. One was a 29-year study of livestock production before GMOs and after GMOs were introduced to the market, and they claim it involved 1 billion live farm animals. But here's the caveat. 95% of the review was for 47 to 49-day-old broiler chickens.
Now, chickens are not used in science.
They're not used in science. There's a reason why you will never, ever find a laboratory animal to determine the efficacy or safety of any drug or any product, you know, using chickens. You use rats, pigs, primates, but they use chickens. And they only looked at chickens for a month and a half, whereas a broiler chicken will live 5 to 7 years. So it was something similar, like the Seralini study. Seralini had to...
In point of fact, some chickens that are allowed to run free in a beautiful environment, because I have such chickens, can live 15 years.
Right. So, of course, and this is production. We're talking about industrial production,
right.
Productive. So this is the kind of research that they were basing it on, correct? Another part of the study was they wanted to look at what was the slaughter rate of livestock animals. And what they found was the slaughter rate, meaning diseased animals, animals that come down sick, you know, in these big industrial farms, that the slaughter rate had decreased. Well, you can take a look at that and say, well, maybe we're just eating more sick and ill animal meat on our tables. That's one. Number two, we could look at the USDA and the EPA, which has slashed so much of its funding that they hardly have any inspectors anymore to even look at these industrial farms. And three, I thought of is that the increase of antibiotic use throughout the livestock industry masks illnesses and diseases. Therefore, more ill and sick animals are going into our meat, into our grocery stores. So that's one study they relied on. The second one, very briefly, at least looked at the toxicology. They at least looked at the toxicology of the GMOs, but again, it was all related to animals, not to humans. And it was primarily a sleight of hand. What I found was France's High Council on Biotechnology looked at this study. It was called the Snell study, and they concluded that it was completely bogus and biased. And this was the headline that was published throughout the French newspapers, such as Le Monde. Not what we get, what I just read to you. And this is where they tried to discredit the Seralini study, which we've spoken on in this program many, many times. You know, Seralini had looked at rats fed GMO grains over the course of the lifespan of the rats. He did not find tumors or anything and ill effects until after the fourth month. What they did was, now the interesting thing in the Seralini study was Seralini designed the study to be a toxicology study. They weren't even expecting cancer, all right? So what the council, the American Academy of Science determined was, well, since Seralini was doing a toxicology study, his carcinogenic findings have to be discredited because he wasn't doing a methodology for carcinogenic study. That was the rationale.
He found massive quantities of mammary cancers.
Mammary hormonal disruption.
And liver cancers.
And kidney failures, right, kidney failures and the huge tumors and all. And so, well, that's pretty much, you could discredit this, but this is
Junk science.
And worse and more dangerous is how our major stream media colludes with junk science, and how careful everybody has to really be and be suspicious of anything, even NPR. I mean, we're talking NPR.
Well, especially NPR.
NPR, right. And Slate, which is very often considered a kind of moderate, more reasonable. So,
okay, well, thank you for doing that.
Okay.
So I just, the takeaway message is when all the mainstream media, all of them, say that something is safe now, that the debate is over, well, they tried to do the same thing with vaccines. It doesn't cause autism, vaccines. No, it does. And so the debate continues, and we will continue to look for the truth and share it with you. And we will post this, our findings of what they did wrong in analyzing these studies and why they cannot make the conclusions they did. Now, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm not going to do today. I'll do tomorrow, 17 reasons to say no to glyphosate this summer, because it'll take me about 10 minutes. And I don't want to keep my guest who's coming on in a moment. So first, we'll only do one of our audio clips today. It's a short one. This young lady has some comments for President Obama and, by extension, the entire liberal corporate community.
My name's Carrie, and I'm on multiple government watch lists for what I post on the internet, but I wasn't always. In 2008, I was actually one of your most hysterical supporters, as you might be able to tell from this shirt that's now vintage. It says that you're my homeboy. I waited for 3 hours in the rain to see Michelle and Stevie Wonder and Oprah campaign on your behalf, and this is me on the night that you were elected, shedding a tear of euphoria because I thought history had been made. But, like a lot of Obama supporters, I sat back for the next couple years and figured I'd let you handle all that change because you're the one that was selling it anyway. And then, when I decided that maybe I should, like, Google the news to see what was going on in the world, I found that you had become exactly like the George Bush that I used to so vitriolically hate. And now, I know that your advisors don't always tell you about all the evil things that are going on in your administration because you're just too busy. At least, that's what you tell the news. So, I thought I'd give you a recap of all of the mayhem and crime that you've been committing.
You bailed out bankers and placed them in your cabinet. You placed Monsanto in charge of your FDA. You helped out pharmaceutical and health insurance companies with Obamacare. You expanded Bush's wars and started new ones with drones, branding yourself a humanitarian warmonger. You bragged about crippling sanctions against Iran, though they directly affected civilians. You extended the Patriot Act and asserted your right to spy on the American people. You also asserted your right to detain them without trial. You even seized the authority to assassinate Americans without providing any evidence of their guilt or offering them due process of law. You viciously punish journalists and pursue whistleblowers who expose your crimes, though you vowed to protect them when you were running for office. You arm al-Qaeda insurgencies, refuse to close Guantanamo, and you, along with Congress, have criminalized protest. And still, you have the audacity to scold dictators about democracy, protest, and freedom.
Mr. Obama, you are the biggest fraud that has ever been perpetrated on the American people, and it's been a long time since I bought into it. So I think it's about time to burn your shirt. I can admit that I probably hated you more than I needed to once I found out what a scam you were. I hated you more than I hated George Bush because I felt personally betrayed by all of the lies that you told. But really, I should thank you now because a few years out from realizing what a scam you were, I understand that it's not just you. See, it's not really Obama's fault because it's the institution of government that is the problem. It doesn't matter what political party is in office. It doesn't matter if it's a liberal or a conservative or you or George Bush or anyone else who will run for president or any other office in government. It's the institution of government that is violent and forceful and coercive and kills people and subjects them to will with a force. And so instead of spreading the same hate that you do with your rhetoric and that you and your fellow politicians decide to inflict on the rest of the world, I would rather spread love and peace and freedom and help people understand that this government that you are currently at the head of, but it really doesn't matter who is strictly violative and doesn't do anything to help them. It only restricts the potential of humanity, and that's what I'd like to share. So thanks, Barack.
Okay, that's her perspective. Now let's go over and say hello to Eva Gollinger, the Venezuelan-American attorney. I gave you her background earlier. She's also the author of The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, and later Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. Her websites are Eva, E-V-A, Gollinger, G-O-L-I-N-G-E-R.com, and thechavezcode.com. Nice to have you with us today, Eva.
Thanks for having me on the show, Gary.
Right now, the U.S. media is trying to convince us that Venezuela is collapsing into a total state of chaos, and this is all the result of Chavez and his legacy. We're being told by the New York Times and the mainstream media that Venezuela is a, quote, hell on earth, end quote, that people are starving and dying in the streets and that it is completely a failed state. This being reported by all the mainstream media, NPR included, and these descriptions, I believe, would have been more accurate to describe the conditions of Venezuelans before Hugo Chavez became president. At that time, Venezuela was ruled by a Washington-friendly oligarchy, a powerful wealthy families, and the nation's social and economic conditions were the basket case of Latin America. It had a poverty rate of 80%, the highest in the region, but like Gaddafi in Libya, Chavez transformed Venezuela to become a nation admired throughout Latin American countries and throughout the continent who are trying to break the yoke of transnational neoliberal economic policies that were impoverishing their populations. He cut the extreme poverty by over 70% and he launched very impressive educational and medical reforms that dramatically improved the lives of Venezuelans. He also was a beacon for many Latin American leaders. So please, Eva, explain why the Chavez revolution was a failure and the role the U.S. government has played in demolishing Venezuela's successes.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say that it was a failure. There are still parts of that legacy that remain very active and vibrant today in Venezuela, such as, number one, its democracy and the level of participation of the people in their political process, but also the fact that they identify with that process, they feel included in it. It's a participatory democracy where people actually have a voice, unlike in the United States. So Venezuela is going through a severe economic crisis, but it's not a failed state, and it's people are not dying in the streets, you know, more so than in other places where they're being shot, like here in the United States, in mass shootings. You know, I mean, obviously Venezuela and its different cities has its problems with crime, and as I was saying, there's a severe economic crisis. There are different factors that have caused that. One of the primary one being the drop in oil prices. Venezuela is completely oil dependent, has the largest oil reserves on the planet, which is a curse on the country because, of course, it's always sought after by powerful interests, primarily the United States and other global economic powers. Always seeking to have a regime in place that's going to be subordinate to that agenda and to those interests. Chavez was not, and that's why his government was constantly under attack, and that's what I documented in my books. And through investigations using Freedom of Information Act, you know, getting documents declassified that showed exactly what the U.S. government was doing, how they funded the opposition in Venezuela, kept them alive, in fact stated that in U.S. government documents specifically that without U.S. government funding, many of those opposition political parties and so-called NGOs would not even exist today. That's not to say that there's not opposition in the country that's legitimate. There certainly is. But, you know, this economic crisis has been, one, caused by the drop in oil prices, which has been quite severe in Venezuela, and the fact that the budget in the country had been accounted for massive social spending, which is what led to the reduction in poverty, you know, giving universal free health care to the people, as well as free education, you know, building new universities and schools, et cetera. All those very successful social policies that remain active today, but are under threat by the situation. There's also mismanagement. Chavez passed away from a very suspicious form and aggressive form of cancer in 2013. And there were elections 30 days later. The current president, Nicolas Maduro, won. And he's not someone who had aspired to be the president. He was Chavez's subordinate. He was a foreign minister, a member of the parliament, and then later vice president before Chavez passed away. So he has not been the greatest leader for Venezuela in these difficult times. There's been mismanagement. There's also been widespread corruption, which is a culture in Venezuela that dates back, 100 years, with this oil coming into the country. The oil wealth has created that culture of corruption. It's been crippling to Venezuela forever, as long as also I've been living there on and off for over 20 years. It's always been that way. And Chavez was able to sort of control it when he was in power. He was a very charismatic leader. Unfortunately, that didn't carry through. And so there was widespread corruption. There was a lot of embezzlement of money, theft, when he was sick and when he passed away. And on top of that, this constant subversion and undermining of Venezuela's government and democracy by these U.S.-funded entities. A couple years ago, the Obama administration imposed sanctions on Venezuela, several sanctions over the years, but they've increased, and they declared Venezuela this extraordinary and unusual threat to U.S. national security, which is ridiculous. And so that sort of opened the door to further actions. As we speak now, actually, in the Organization of American States, which is a regional body of all Latin American nations plus the U.S. and Canada, the current OAS Secretary General is convening a meeting. They're meeting now in Washington, backed by the United States primarily, to invoke what's called the Democratic Charter against Venezuela, which basically says it's a failed state. Democracy, the constitutional order has been ruptured, and therefore Venezuela should be suspended, and it will open the door to an intervention of some sort. This has been, of course, rejected by Venezuela and by a majority of member states, but those backed by the U.S., and as we've seen increasingly, states have been damaged or falling in the region from leftist governments that were in power, such as in Argentina. There's a right-wing government, neoliberal agenda. And then, of course, Brazil, where there was actually a coup d'etat that ousted Dilma Rousseff from power and has now installed this corrupt regime that could never have been elected, because actually the current president, Michel Temer, is unelectable. He's prohibited from running for office because of corruption charges. I mean, it's all outrageous that Venezuela is being put on the spot as, to invoke this democratic charter, justify an intervention, say that it's a failed state, when actually in the region we have the case of Brazil, where there is a coup in place. The U.S. has remained silent on that because now the government in place is friendly to U.S. agenda. And then Mexico, where they're assassinating teachers, they still haven't given answers to the 43 disappeared students, that were killed by state forces. I mean, that's a place where we see actual state violence taking place, and mum's the word in U.S. media. And in all, in U.S. discourse through Department of State, we don't hear them talking about that being a failed state or needing some kind of external intervention. Ironically, President of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, right now arrived to Cuba, where they're about to witness the signing of a historical peace accord between the government of Colombia and the FARC, the Armed Revolutionary Forces of Colombia, the guerrilla group. They've had a civil war for over 50 years. Venezuela has played the primary role in facilitating a peace dialogue for the past 4 years, basically, that now has come to fruition, and today is the day they're signing this historic accord of a ceasefire, which then will lead to the peace agreement and end the war in Colombia. So I just wanted to point out that how ironic is that at this moment, as that's taking place in Venezuela, is, in the spotlight in Cuba for Colombia, for having played this key role in bringing peace to that country, that in Washington, there's a group of, Washington-backed people are calling for an intervention in Venezuela for Venezuela being a failed state. I mean, it's the upside-down world where we see the New York Times calling for an intervention in Venezuela, basically justifying any kind of action, military or otherwise, to remove President Maduro from power. And then we have all these other instances in the region, where U.S.-backed governments are violating rights, state violence, coups, things like that, and they say absolutely nothing.
Final question, short answer, if you would, please. What role do you see Hillary Clinton playing if she becomes president in Venezuela or other left or liberal or more democratically balanced communities in Central and South America?
Well, I believe that U.S. foreign policy in general is a state policy. It doesn't really matter who's in office. That's been true in the case of Venezuela. When Bush was in power, there was equal aggression. Actually, I would say that Obama increased the aggression. It's sort of been just escalating over the years since the job wasn't finished. You know, Chavez was able to be disappeared by whatever means, but, you know, there's now this increased effort to oust this government and just destroy the Bolivarian Revolution, which is the name of that political process that Chavez led. But I do think, you know, certainly that Hillary Clinton, as she's spoken about it and the actions that she took in the Department of State, where she facilitated a coup in Honduras against a president who was leaning leftward and joining in Latin American unity and, you know, looking more towards the south and towards the north, she certainly and acknowledges the role that she played in that coup. So I think that it would be detrimental to, you know, the governments in the region and the social movements in the region that have been successfully over the past 15 years implementing systems that are more based on social justice. I think she probably would increase the aggression towards Venezuela if they don't achieve their goal this year, and certainly towards those remaining governments in the region. We still have Ecuador and Bolivia, where there are strong leaders in place, but next year Ecuador's has presidential elections, everything could change, and then 2 years later, Bolivia.
Eva, thank you for the good work that you do down there and bringing it back to the United States. The book is The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, and previous Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. Her website is evagullinger.com. Thank you for your input, Eva. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow at noon.